philosophy and the theology and the defense of the faith. It's really a course in apologetics on an advanced level, which I'm using my own book with, I hope, due humility and due apology for the price, which I did not set. Well, that's it. And we, if I remember correctly, we were up to we were up to Darwinism, were we not? What page did we end? I'm
135.
I thought we were. I have an important paragraph in 135, which I'd like to discuss with you. Underlying both 19th century philosophy and scientific endeavor was the growing revolt, against biblical theology and Islamic Christian thought, both Roman Catholic and Protestant. The biblical doctrines of a sovereign God who created man in his own image and so on, a depravity and need of redemption through the work of Christ became increasingly foreign to the mind of the 19th century. This mind had been prepared and nurtured by philosophy and revolutionary activity to believe in the sufficiency of man to achieve his own redemption through the application of his own unlimited wisdom to the problems which confronted him. These historic doctrines stood in the way of this undoubted optimism. Now, I want to make this point very clear. The 19th century carried on the optimism of the latter part of the 18th century, that optimism which had engulfed and strengthened the French revolutionary thought, but it had a new foundation. No longer did it rely on the philosophy of a previous age. It wrapped itself around and claimed for itself scientific evolutionarism. Thus, the Darwinism had tremendous impact upon the 19th century mind. It is not and was not at that time, and never has been, simply a biological theory. It is not, of course, but almost at once, as soon as Darwin had published his Origin of Species, the attempt began to create a new world and life view. A view of God, man, sin, society, history, government, education, psychology, psychiatry, art, music, literature, which would be evolutionary in its context. It would look to evolution. It wouldn't look to ancient man. It wouldn't look to Plato. It wouldn't look even to Newton. It would look to Darwin. And on the basis of the Darwinian hypothesis, it would erect a totally new frame of reference by which these social engineers hope to restructure all of man's political, social, economic, and cultural endeavors. And thus we come to page 136, Herbert Spencer. How many of you ever studied Herbert Spencer? How many of you are familiar with him at all? He was an English sociologist, philosopher, and I point out he was one of the first to use this theory of evolution to do what? To forge a whole new world and life view based upon, a biological view, and perhaps I should have strengthened by saying an evolutionary biological view of human nature. His effort to create such a synthetic philosophy appeared first in his Social Statics, in which he proclaimed the conviction that the time had come to synthesize all knowledge. And so he began to write his synthetic philosophy. And he worked on it for 33 years. But note how he began, student. Where would knowledge begin? Where would he center his knowledge? Where would he center his activity? Note his first work, The Principles of Sociology. Note this. What did he do in those Principles of Sociology? To set forth what? A biological view of man. Now, some of you have been amused, no doubt, as I have sought to slay the dragon of sociology. And I have done so because I have recognized that along with psychology and the compatriot study, psychiatry, sociology has, to a great extent, captured the modern mind in this country. And as I said before, it was conceived in sin and born in iniquity and has no legitimate standing. It has no traditional standing in solid knowledge. It borrows from biology, it borrows from zoology, it borrows as little from history as it possibly can, it borrows a false psychology,
and creates a totally false view of human society. Now there are a few sociologists who do not fall under this judgment. Both of them are dead. Potem Sorokin, the famous Polish sociologist at Harvard, and Florian Zaniecki. And he died, three, 4 months ago, something like that. Maybe 6 months. Both of them were scholars, and both of them were trained historians. Now, in 1864, Spencer set forth his first principles. In it, he announced the ultimate nature of reality is unknowable. Note, the ultimate nature of reality is unknowable. But of whom does that remind you? Rusty? The ultimate nature of reality is unknowable. Kant, with his unknowable noumenal. Remember that? In other words, according to Spencer, you cannot know the essence of anything. Declaring that, and note my point, declaring the ultimate reality is unknowable, he proceeded to say a great deal about it, which is exactly what Kant did, didn't he? Saying the noumenal world cannot be known, he then located the noumenal world. He said that death, freedom, love, God, and immortality are where? In the world you cannot know. And by definition, as I said, if you cannot know the noumenal world, you can make no predication about it. You cannot say that it has certain attributes, like God, freedom, and immortality. So Spencer falls in the same error, saying you cannot know it. If you cannot know it, then you may not dare to make a statement that doesn't exist. For me to say something doesn't exist, which you cannot know, makes absolutely no sense. And for me to say that something doesn't exist presupposes a certain knowledge of the thing which does not exist. Or you dare not make a statement that doesn't exist. It may be negative knowledge, but it's still a knowledge. Now, they're having made these declarations, which are distinctly unbiblical. Spencer unblushingly applied the principles of evolution to all finite phenomena, including human beings and their social organizations. Now, you see what Spencer did. He was the first English sociologist. And he was the influence upon American sociology, as I shall show you later. What does he say? Society is to be understood only in terms of an evolutionary hypothesis. Society can only be interpreted in terms of the Darwinian thesis. Now, this is true today. I personally, have never met a sociologist who was not to a greater or lesser degree influenced by evolutionary thinking.
Would this presuppose that society was improving?
It's not only presupposes that, that is the real reason for the whole thing. In other words, man corporately can improve himself. I start off on page 135 with such assertions. You see, now, Spencer is an ardent evolutionist, which means that man can improve himself. But for a sociologist, that has a broader connotation. It means that society itself can improve itself. Now, when we come to Lester Frank Ward, I shall show you more about this. But you see, what Spencer and Lester Frank Ward taught was this, that any given period in the history of a society, in any given period of a society's history, that society may acquire certain characteristics, planned characteristics. And as it acquires those planned characteristics, it may transmit those planned characteristics, acquired characteristics, to a succeeding generation. And if each generation does that, then you see all there'll be bumps. But, society is going in an upward spiral constantly because each generation decides what improvement it wants in the way of its characteristics, and then it achieves those characteristics by social planning, and then it passes them on to the next generation.
Do you think somebody today can major in sociology in college with a
born-again
Christian outlook and come out with a sound mind? I guess it depends on how
long
he is.
Right? I wouldn't say it can't be. Do you get me, Danny? I would not say it cannot be done, because there are strong Christians who can do it. But I certainly would not advise the average 18, 19, 20, 21-year-old student to do it. I would not advise it for two reasons. The sound knowledge which can be gained, and there is some, the sound knowledge which can be gained in a sociology major is derived from other sources. Am I right? Am I not right in there? Now, you're sitting next to a living example of a fellow who's done it. You were a sociology major, if I remember right. And he has done it. And I'm not just trying to flatter Rusty. He has done it. And he did, of course, in the context of Covenant College. But I think you'll agree that Covenant College, by the nature of the case, has had to use pagan textbooks. Now, there's an advantage of that. If a strong professor will point out the abundant errors, I don't know what text you used, but a professor's alert to those developments can really help you, even if though you have to use those textbooks. And I certainly would not say that it can't be done. I said I would not expose a normal 18-year-old. Would you or would you not? Now, you may disagree with me. Well, I was going to say, I would agree with that. And I would say that at Covenant College, if I had young people in my family well ground the faith, I think I would go along with that. I would agree with Rusty. But I would not allow any of my own children to go to Chapel Hill and do that, University of North Carolina. I wouldn't send them over to Athens and do that. I mean, Athens, Georgia. I'll tell you something else. And this is a clue. Generally speaking, there are exceptions. When you have strong, good technical agricultural schools like Clemson, which is a good agricultural school, I know they laugh at it because I taught at Furman, but Clemson is a good, strong agricultural technical college. Generally speaking, the men who do work, say, in sociology, or even North Carolina State, at Ross, do not have the same attitude. And generally speaking, I hate to use the word, they're much less harmful or more inaccurate than with the same department, be it Chapel Hill or University of South Carolina or University of Georgia. For instance, in the business school at Georgia Tech, there's a great deal of real basic conservatism, which you wouldn't find at the University of Georgia. Now, this seems to be traditionally true, and I don't know exactly the reason. I can't dogmatize. I simply point it out. And I would answer your question. I would think it can be done. But for an 18-year-old, not a 22, I would, in the normal course of events, I would be hesitant about allowing them to do it. If you major in sociology, and this is somewhat of the point, I guess, you are defrauding yourself of the richer course material that could be gained in other departments.
Are you speaking Christian material, or are you speaking from?
I'm speaking of the courses in. I'm speaking of the culture which is available, the heritage, the intellectual, social, cultural inheritance which should be available on a senior college campus.
From a cultural standpoint.
Uh-huh. Or university standpoint.
Well, isn't it all pretty Darwin?
Yes, it is. Now, we already been through to say, Dick, that with a strong man, young man of faith, such as Rusty, or your son, I don't know, is it Tommy Jr.?
Right.
At Clemson, has that? I would say, yeah, he's at Clemson.
Right.
I would say that he's not in danger of losing his faith. I was making another point. That to the extent to which he has to take courses in sociology, he is depriving himself of the richness of a curriculum offered at whatever school it is. Covenant is a special situation in which it's an extension, and I know the men in history there. I know what they stand for, and I have great confidence. I see your point. I wasn't aware of that. See, when sociology becomes based in history,
It loses its fangs to a great extent. And I suppose that's by intent there, rather. I'm sure it's not. Well, that's an unusual situation then, I'll have to admit. Now, that was a little bit off. And yet, I'm trying to make this course fit into your pastoral experience, which is awaiting you, and what you're going to run up against. At one point at the very bottom of the page, when Spencer spoke of the laws of biology, he had in mind the law of the survival of the fittest and the transmission of acquired characteristics in and by surviving individuals of any species. Now, Spencer combined here the struggle to survive inherent in Darwin with the survival of the fittest. And in his concept of man and society, he looked upon any society as a source of perpetual conflict in which, within that society, all the competing members would struggle to survive. And that the struggle to survive would produce a hardier race culturally. Even as Darwin said, that the strongest of any particular species survive in the race for survival and become physically fit. Spencer transferred that to society and said, if you're intellectually able to survive, then in the struggle within that particular group, you will have acquired certain strong characteristics. And thus a society which develops a surviving group who have acquired strong characteristics, desirable characteristics, that group will pass that on to its succeeding generation. And that generation will be the richer because of the struggle in the previous generation, and then that next generation will engage in the struggle, and the weak will die off, and the strong will survive, and they will transmit to the third generation. That's what he means by this. And you see, in the struggle to survive, you acquire certain desirable characteristics, and then as you acquire them, you transmit them to the succeeding generation. Now, this Darwin never questioned it. Today, even evolutionary philosophers and evolutionary biologists don't hold to this. It's highly suspect. Yes. Mm-hmm. That was the educational philosophy which was derived from it. Yes. Yeah. And in the sense of acquired characteristics. 1937, then what was his ultimate goal? Note, the society must achieve a state of peace and prosperity. And when this goal had been achieved, the state would no longer be necessary. In short, for Spencer, the state is a kind of necessary evil, which should have both limited functions and limited powers. Because as society, through this competitive life in which it engages, as it acquires and finally achieves this equilibrium of peace and so on, and prosperity, the state's no longer necessary. It will fluff off. Thus, you see, Spencer believed in an unfettered social and economic freedom, as well as political freedom, and held to a conception of free enterprise in keeping with the utilitarian assumptions. In other words, and this came right in this country, Spencer believed that if Company A is stronger than Company B, and if it's a better company, then it should be allowed to take over or wipe out of existence Company B, simply because Company B is weak. And in the economic realm, the struggle to survive will produce, say, a strong General Motors, and let Chrysler die. Chrysler deserves to die, according to Spencer. Southern Airlines deserves to die, and will be taken by the Northwestern Airlines and become a republic.
Capitalism.
Well, perish the thought.
And free enterprise.
Yes.
If a company is mismanaged and
thus is lost, the concept is too bad. Yes, not necessarily for reasons they assign it to it, though. I mean, there are other aspects of which I'm not touching upon tonight. I'm not referring to the Chrysler either, incidentally. Let me get Chrysler's always been noted for fine engineering, but apparently they didn't see this whole gas problem coming. And
poor marketing.
Poor marketing, I would say. Would you not say that, or should I put you on the spot?
Well, I thought that was a good guy who worked for Chrysler while they started off as a fine engineering.
I know they did.
What happened, the engineering management went out and the finance management came in, and they continued to exist with a fine engineering image, which wasn't really there. And so they got into not having the product to meet the requirements of the people.
Well, it wasn't that General Motors killed them off, and of course they're not dead. It is that they, with internal management problems, they didn't meet the demand. This has happened many times. It happened with the Studebaker Corporation. Packard, Studebaker. Of course, Hudson went in with the other company that came out, American Motors, the Nash. Hudson Nash went together and came out under American Motors. There was a time when the stagecoaches were a big thing, but they couldn't compete with the railroads, and if you persisted in running a stagecoach in 1950 or 1970 to the West Coast, you wouldn't have many passengers. Although I'm thinking seriously reviving the Pony Express for the mail.
Well, look at the Crosley.
Yeah, it wasn't much of
20 years ahead of time.
Yeah.
Today it'd be a
well, that's a marketing problem.
Yeah.
I mailed a letter to the college somewhere here on Tuesday, and Tug said just before she left today, she got it. You were there to hear it. Well, now that's only from Tuesday to Friday to go 300 miles.
And you've been all over the place.
I've been to Birmingham and back. And I didn't leave on Tuesday. In fact, I left on Wednesday. And spent a lot of time, spent over two days in Birmingham. So you see, this is not the same thing as what Spencer. Spencer believed in ruthless competition. And I mean no offense, if here in days say, well, if General Motors is that good, then let Chrysler die. And don't do anything to prohibit General Motors from becoming strong. By engaging in the most unfair kind of competitive practice, rather give a blessing to it. And if Delta Airlines wants to kill off Eastern, don't stop Delta. But sort of put them back, say, go to us. Eastern's too big anyway, and just reduce them in size and let them die. And change your rates overnight and have extra special fares, super duper savers, going like that, and beat Eastern its own game. Not that I want Eastern to die. I'm just using an illustration. Or Eastern could do it to Delta.
Delta
do. What? Delta. Eastern doing it to Delta. Delta.
Yeah, my neighbor, the Galvin citizen, he came in. He said that they didn't have enough people to come from Baltimore to Atlanta, so they canceled the trip.
So Eastern or Delta?
So that's against law.
Uh-huh. I didn't think they're supposed to cancel trip things.
They aren't legally allowed to.
Unless it's a weather situation. Then it's no problem. Now, have I made my point clear in giving you these illustrations? Do you have a point here? I meant no offense to General Motors when what I said. I was simply using illustrations. I'm not for a moment charging them of doing that. Well, do you understand what I'm getting at? See, he believed in an unbiblical form of freedom. Unbiblical in the sense that there's no moral law to govern human activity. He says biological law, and biological law allows you. As a matter of fact, it puts a blessing upon those who are fit to a fierce competitive struggle. But there's no moral law to guide the conduct of individuals or corporations. But please note something. In this instance, that you hear talk about corporate sin. And it's used by liberals who do not believe in the moral law of God. And there is no way to say that a corporation sins if there's no moral law against which it may sin. Nor can an individual be guilty of sin unless he sins against the moral law of God. Nor can a corporation be held accountable if those who are bringing the charge of corporate sin do not believe in the moral law.
But seeing me,
Doctor,
I think that most of
the thinking is very expensive. But sure it is. I'm going to go.
I don't think so. A lot, well, there's some of that, but a lot of it, in terms of freedom, is less and less freedom, and with the state taking over some of these.
Now, both of you are correct. See, what happens is this, that when you, this is a very good point, which Dennis has brought up. When you proclaim a moral or lack of moral state in which there's no moral law, and sinners, unregenerate man, will take advantage of that situation until life becomes unbearable. And so society reacts against it by creating a super totalitarian absolute state to enforce a human-made, a man-made morality in place of the divine morality, which they have rejected. And you see, then the super state becomes a god, and it creates a man-made morality. And it will create the image of corporate sin to indict corporations. And it will, in a court, it will say, men are antisocial. And so they'll lock you up, not because you broke the law of God, but because you're antisocial in your behavior. How many times have you heard the phrase antisocial behavior? Ad nauseam. You see, and they create a new terminology. For us, a person who commits two or three murders or one murder is not antisocial, he's a murderer. And he's guilty of violating the law of God. For a modern sociological judge, he will say, oh, the man's antisocial, and so we will put him in prison, and we will put him through a process of transformation. We will reconstruct him, and we will make him an socially acceptable being again. Which they don't, of course, in about 75% of the cases. Like a dog returning to his vomit, they return to their vomit, namely the sin they had committed in the first place.
That's the dilemma, isn't it?
Yes. The totalitarian state is born out of this erroneous concept of freedom, which was brought in by the evolutionists. See, when you have a non-biblical concept of freedom, you end up by destroying the freedom you do have. This is what I was saying one night when we were talking about Hegel, a month or so ago, in which I pointed out that the doctrine of human rights is held today as one of the most viciously dangerous doctrines there is. Because it creates a synthetic concept of human rights and is busily at work at the same time destroying the human rights which we do possess. These people who go about yelling human rights, what are they doing? They are for abortion, thus they are endorsing murder. They are for sex outside of marriage, free love, and a false freedom. They're destroying the biblical, the family, and they are crying, peace, peace, and you should disarm to have peace. And they would disarm you and allow the Russians to kill you. And thus, but ultimately, what we've seen today in Hitler, in Stalin, in England, in France, now in this country, is the creation of a totalitarian regime disguised as democracy in order to use enough power to ward off the antisocial conduct of those who are abusing this freedom as they see it being abused.
Well, it is being abused.
Sure. Oh, sure. It is being abused. But you see, the solution does not lie in creation of a totalitarian state, which itself is abuse of freedom.
Well, how do you approach it from a pagan society such as ours? I mean, I don't see any other alternative.
I do.
What?
Preaching the gospel.
Well, I mean, outside of conversion.
Well, okay. I agree that outside of conversion, there is no answer. But the thing that's remarkable, and I've seen it happen so many times, when liberals are converted to Christianity, they immediately forsake their political, economic, and social liberalism and turn against the whole thing. Maybe not immediately sometimes, but they do it. Sometimes immediately, sometimes it takes growth and grace. But this is one of the main changes.
Well, the question is, can enough be converted to make an impact?
I don't know. that's a question I cannot answer. I would also point out to you, though, that throughout history, it has never taken a majority. It has taken what, and here at this point, I do agree with Arnold Toynbee, the creative minority. A creative, dynamic minority which has the inner ability to win the support and the following of the majority can save the nation. Majorities never save anything. Majorities, by their nature, are destructive. But creative minorities.
That.
Yes.
Who was that?
Arnold Toynbee in his study of history, 10 volumes, 1937, 1961, Oxford University Press. Actually, 12 volumes, but the main thrust is in the first 10 volumes. Mr. Pierce, any questions?
Not so far. Well, I got a lot of questions, but I mean.
Well, any disagreements then?
No.
Well, don't be hesitant now. Don't follow that. Now, let's look at the bottom of 137, because this is the crowning point. This is not as now, you see, Spencer held to the survival of the fittest as the concept for the key to progress. It is at this very point, however, that the fundamental weakness of his position becomes very apparent. Irrationalism stalks him at every point in his philosophical outlook. It is contradictory to speak of freedom within the context of evolutionary philosophy, which is dominated by a theory of determinism. This is what I'm saying. You see, modern evolutionary theory is deterministic at every point. It is sheer determinism. Now, within the framework of philosophical determinism, whether it be that of the evolutionary philosophy or that of the Stoics or that of Kant or Hegel, as the case may be, it is folly. It is contradictory to speak of freedom. Freedom can be born of determinism. Ah, and you explain to me something. But what about the Calvinistic view of sovereignty of God? You see, God is not determined. He is all powerful. Calvinism is the opposite of determinism. The evolutionary or philosophic, whatever it might be. Began by denying the sovereign God. By denying God who knows all and who does everything well from the very beginning, who has predestined his elect unto redemption, who has predestined his church, who has foreordained that we shall believe in the truth. And the truth shall make you free. To know Christ is another truth. To know Christ, therefore, to be free. Illusory liberalism based upon evolutionary philosophy can only end in totalitarianism. And this is what's happened in today's world from 1914, 1920 on. Yes.
In determinism, at this point, we're not talking about man determining.
No.
We're talking about biological nature.
You see, correct. For Spencer, as for Darwin, and for those who will follow what William Graham Summer I'm taking up next, these men regarded social evolution as much deterministic as biological evolution. In other words, they held that the same laws of nature which determine the physical evolution of man, of the species and man ultimately, that this law of nature is just as applicable to human society as it is to the human physical frame. And there's no more freedom for man in his social, political, economic activity than there is in the fish who first decides you'll be a bird.
Because of the deterministic nature of biology.
You see, the natural law which they envisage is a law which is devoid of purpose. It has no God in whom it has its origin. It has no meaning, has no goal, and has no moral quality. You see, this is a, let me show you. This bullet, hurry if I drop it. All right, now look, all right. I dropped that book. It is responding to the law of gravity. It made a noise. Now, that book cannot get up here. And I don't want to fall. I'm going to fool this thing. I'm going to stay up here. Can't do that. It will fall. It will obey the law of gravity. It will go down a straight line. And it will hit. I don't know. Do you? When I was supplying a church up in Winston Sound, a Presbyterian church, a family in the church went out to a place called Hanging Rock State Park. Any of you know where it is? And there's a beautiful little waterfall there. And while they were there, some rocks became dislodged and almost killed the girl. In fact, they pinned her up against the wall of the where the falls were going down. Now, I'm being fanciful, but I remember telling the people at the time. Now, that rock didn't say, well, I'm going to get Marie. I'm going to go and get that wall. It just so happened to have been some heavy rain, and the rocks, or some of the rocks had been in the lodge, dislodged, they were hanging by a thread, and when the wind came up, it blew them down. But that rock had no prevision, had no foreknowledge, had nothing that was going to hit Marie. It did, however. Fortunately, it did not hurt her, just pinned her against the wall of the canyon. But it could have killed her, for that matter. But it didn't do it by design, it had no goal, and it didn't know what it was doing. It simply was obeying the law of gravity. Now, this is the way that Spencer, William Graham Sumner, and many others today view this whole concept of natural law. It's denuded of personality, it's denuded of will. It's amoral or immoral, as the case may be. But it has no, that rock had no intention of killing the girl. She just happened to be there when it happened. The rock fell. You see, and that's the whole vision they have of natural law. Yes, it would have been God who had been controlling the event. He controlled the events that were. Now, what the purpose, I don't know. Maybe to bring her closer to him, which it did. But I think it had an impact on the whole family. Now, you see, evolution then destroys the biblical concept of man and of his society. And to the extent to which it becomes the frame of reference for all human activity, it renders meaningless and irrational all the human activity which it directs. Tommy, do you have a question? Now, let's go to William Graham Sumner. William Graham Sumner is one of Spencer's first disciples in this country, and it was with him that the seeds of that irrationalism which had been so carefully nurtured or nourished in his mentor in England were brought to the United States. However, Sumner was even or much more thoroughly Darwinian than was Spencer. Now, here's the irony of the situation. Sumner was an Episcopalian rector at a place called Teaneck, New Jersey, which I understand is across the Hudson River from New York. Is that correct? Mr. Free, are you from New York or any place like that?
No. I
didn't know if you were or not. Being with General Motors, you could be from most anywhere. Well, I understand it's a very fashionable town across the river. Now, William Graham Sumner, a young rector, went to England to study. And he came under the influence of Spencer and the Darwinians. He came back and decided he wanted to be a professor, and he asked Noah Porter, who at that time was president of Yale College, if he could teach in the Yale Divinity School. And Noah Porter, in essence, though not while he was president of college, he couldn't. But here's where Noah Porter made a fatal mistake, in spite of his good intentions. He did make him professor of political economy. Now, political economy at that time was a combination of political thought and economic thought and the impact of business. And for about 40 years, William Graham Sumner taught 10 complete college generations at Yale. In other words, he saw 10 complete classes go through there, 10 times 4. Now, he was thoroughly imbued with Darwinism. And he came away with what we might call a completely naturalistic concept of man and his society. Now listen to him at the bottom of the page. If we do not like the survival of the fittest, we have only one possible alternative, and that is survival of the unfittest. The former is the law of civilization. Note, the former, namely the law of the survival of the fittest, is what? It's the law of civilization. The latter is a law of anti-civilization. We have our choice between the two. But a third plan, a social desideratum, a plan for nourishing the unfittest and yet advancing civilization, no man will ever find. What's he saying then? No plan for advancing civilization can be found. He denied the transmission of acquired characteristics. He simply believed in the survival of the fittest. And may the fit survive. Long live. What Yale has today is that a debate is a derivative of this, which has become even more irrational and naturalistic. See, Sumner did hold to a fixed law. Listen to this. The truth is the social order is fixed by the law of nature, precisely analogous to the physical order. The most that man can do is by his ignorance and conceit is to mar the operation of social laws. And then here's the final conclusion. This is a famous quote, which I got from Folkways, Boston. Listen to this. This is the ethical application. Nothing but might has ever made right. And this is but an echo of what? Machiavelli. There much is the rich. Translated from the Irish. Might is right. And if we include in might as we ought, elections and the doctrines of the courts. Note, he's talking about the philosophy of democracy. Nothing but might makes right now. In other words, the majority at any given time is right simply because it has what? The might. And note, and if a thing has been done and is established by force, and by that he meant that no force can reverse it, it is right what? In the only sense we can know right. And rights will follow from it. Oh, here's a clinker. I'm going to go back to this. From which there are, will follow from it, which are not vitiated at all by the forces in it. There would be no security at all for rights if this were not so. Now, this is irrationalism unmasked at its worst. In other words, the only right that you and I know is the right of force. Now, let us remember that when he was writing this, Darwin, Marx, and Wagner were in active correspondence with each other, and Darwin had, by 1866, furnished to Marx the doctrine of force involved in the theory of evolution, so that Marx applied this in his Das Kapital, and he incidentally, as I told you before, dedicated the first edition to Charles Darwin for helping him. Wagner and his magic cycle, Magic Ring, is praising the Teutons, the Teutons, for their great heritage, and he's proclaiming might is right. Wagner's son-in-law, Houston Stuart Chamberlain, wrote a book to this purpose in England on the eve of World War I. So the doctrine that might is right was sweeping the intellectual world. Now, let's look, Mr. Free, here. I thought you had a point.
No, I was just thinking, I'm trying to get in my mind exactly where we are in the framework.
Today, you mean in our...
We are progressing, I guess, down the road, and I'm thinking today
Well, now the rest of this book is dedicated to the answering of that question.
Okay, I understand.
The book is dedicated and will answer that question. You see, at this point, in that last quote, what is William Graham Sumner saying? He is saying that right, that might makes right. And then he adds another, and the only right that we know is that which is established by force. And out of this all-powerful force come the only rights we can know. Now, do you see the danger at this point? I mean, rights are established by might, which is to say that if I am stronger than you, I can demolish your rights simply by sheer physical strength. Or if you're stronger than I am, you can do the same thing to me. Or a nation like Nazi Germany can liquidate Austria, which it did, and make it right, because Austria couldn't overcome the German might. Or Russia can overcome Afghanistan, or Poland, or Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, and so on, and it cannot be overcome. Why? Because Russia, having the might, also, ipso facto, has what? The force. Because it has the force, it has established the right, and the only way you and I can know right. In other words, this natural law concept of rights simply says that rights come from force. Now, the biblical view is that rights come from the duties we owe to God. Our rights are not in themselves. They're not entities which are not subject to law. But all real rights arise from duties. Life, liberty, and property are rights. But we, because we owe duties in those three areas to God. The right to marriage, the right to marriage is a result of our obligation to propagate the race and to marry. What's the matter with you?
I like that. On the radio today, a man was the editor of Democracy Magazine, and he was basically saying, although he sounded as though he might have had a little liberal bent to him, that we are in deep trouble.
Yeah.
Demographically speaking, the United States of America is going to have to change this. Mm-hmm. He said, now, here I presented to you the fact. Now, I know that some population control people are not going to like that. But he proposed, as a matter of fact, he proposed retirement based upon fertility. That if you produce three sons, that therefore you could retire earlier than a person who produced no sons.
Eastern Airlines would lose a pilot right soon now.
And if you had produced
No sons, you
might have to work for all of your life.
So you're 75 or 80
right.
To atone for that lack of fertility. Well, I wouldn't go along on that point, but I would point this out to you. That modern liberalism, which derives itself from this very evolutionary concept, is in deep trouble because, you see, they are asking for smaller and smaller families. They're constantly having this bugging fear of population explosion. Well, that's not true. The reverse is true. And what has happened today is that the whole social structure, the whole Roosevelt, Truman, Johnson, whatnot, security program is in dire danger because you have more and more people not working and fewer people working because you have fewer and fewer people having babies to have babies to have babies. And so they're in danger, the whole thing.
In 1930, the number of people working was 30 for every one person retired on Social Security. But now it's 3-1, and by the year 2000, it'll be 2-1.
Or less, assuming the present state continues.
And the birth rate is continuing.
Yeah. But to make the matter worse, those who are prone to live off the state are reproducing a faster rate than those who maintain the state. So that those figures are much more alarming than the mathematical ratio would allow you to believe.
Yeah, but listen to the
control. No, they haven't. And now they have dug themselves a grave from which there's no escape. Is there any question before we go on to other topics? Well, I'm not. Am I, you hungry?
No, I have a question.
Oh, you have a question? Oh. Yeah, well, we've been going for an hour and a quarter. Let's go for, what do you say? Let's go to 8 o'clock. What do you say? Is that agreeable to you, Saint?
Dr. Yaw.
Yes, sir?
Definition of sociology is that man.
Strictly speaking, the word sociology means the study of society. The phrase was coined by Auguste Comte in the 1850s, a French sociologist. It has come to me, not only the study of society, but the human planning to produce a better society. And of course, once you adopt the evolutionary concept as we get it, and I shall go next to Lester Frank Ward, I shall show you what happened. Sociology then became a viciously dangerous thing as it endorsed, taking away children from parents, loosening the marriage laws, sex out of marriage, promiscuity, then the obvious implication, when you're promiscuous, you have to have an abortion from their point of view. And it becomes a very vicious cycle. I said, when I kind of look to Frank Ware, it becomes more of this. But you are correct. Sociology is literally a study of society, but it is no longer simply a study of society. At one time, sociology was a gathering of statistics. How many babies are born with blue eyes? What's the average number of children in the family? What's the average schooling in the family? Rather innocuous on their parents, but actually it was not, because they were gathering data on which to promulgate their vicious doctrine. And you see, you will see in the present census of 1980 the very dangerous influence of sociology. Now it's, we only want to know a few things. How many times do you whip your kids? The answer would be not often enough for many families. How many times do you kiss your wife? Of course, it's none of their business.
Neither
is the first one either. That's true. Neither one of them. But
is that going to be on the?
I don't know. But yeah, undoubtedly personal questions. I don't know about that particular question. I did hear somebody say there might be a question on how many times you whip your children.
Well, now, it wasn't a month ago that the Atlanta Journal published a big article on the fact that the average American adult does not know the difference between discipline and child abuse.
The Atlanta Journal is not my first line of journalistic accuracy.
That's based upon things that people that are making those up literally ask questions. Along those lines, I had a detailed report from a woman out in Texas, and she said the same type of thing. People do not know the difference.
Was that the Gabriel girl?
I don't know the name exactly, but
she's smart.
She considered that, she said some people would consider showing a child a pornographic picture as child abuse, and she didn't think that way. I do. She considered spanking, the version being child abuse. I don't. You see, that's the thing she's saying. She has taken a presupposition, and I assume that's where that article could be coming from.
I think the article.
Opening the door for what you're
saying. It sure is. That's intended to.
People thinking, well,
It's intended to.
I was really floored.
And you should be. Now, I don't know exactly what kind of questions. I know they're going to be personal questions, and I know that the sociology is going to use them as a means of denying parental rights to children. Now, I would agree that showing pornography is certainly pornographic. I'm not arguing that point. But how many parents show their children pornographic pictures?
Well, and I think most females get from child abuse and discipline.
Yeah, but you see, the sociologist would say, if my child does something very serious, I have to give them a good clipping. They said, well, you're abusing a child.
That's what the case of the sociologist is doing.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That's what that paper was running
for. I don't know if I told you all about the situation that I had. A young couple in the church I was pastoring had to move because he's manager of a food town store. And, he was assistant. They promoted him. Of course, they moved him to a vacancy down at Fayetteville, or right near Fayetteville. And they couldn't find a home, so they took an apartment. And it just so happened that they took an apartment next door to a social worker in the county, and his wife. And his wife was a gardener, and she had a lot of flowers. And the little girl, 3 and 5, picked some flowers as they grew. When they grew over the fence, they picked them, take their mama. Well, the lady she objected rather violently, and so the girl whom I've known for over 20 years, because she grew up my own daughter, she simply kept the children indoors unless she could be out there with them. And the husband of the wife, the social worker, he went and tried to get a court order to have the children taken away from the parents because they were being cruel to the children. And his own wife was the cause of the problem to begin with. And secondly, they were not being cruel to children. And it wasn't that they didn't let them out. They didn't let them out when the mother could not be with them. That was to keep them from from picking the flowers when she didn't want them to. And fortunately, there was before a judge blessed with some common sense when the case was brought into court. And this social worker actually brought the case to court. The judge laughed him out of court and told him it was ridiculous. And he better not come back again with such... What he meant was just rot. That he couldn't be bothered listening to this sort of foolishness out of the social worker and saying going back in his box. But other judges are not so gifted with sanctified common sense and would listen to that claptrap, you see. And whether the judge would do it or not, the fact is that the social worker was making an issue out of it, yeah, and calling it child abuse, which it most certainly was not. Under the law, it is. Under the law, when a social worker reports a case of child abuse, the case cannot be just ignored. I mean, you have to hear it. Yeah, I've been quite not every day, but I have had 4 children, 2 boys, 2 girls, and at times I sort of lay the law down. How many children do you have, Mr. Sears? Well, have you laid the law down a few times? And I didn't feel like I was abusing a child. I might have abused certain portions of the anatomy.
But they didn't die.
They're very healthy and they're very loving. And just this last week, I stayed with my older daughter in Birmingham, and I was speaking over there, and she and I got talking one night. She said, "Dad," she said, "we all knew what you did. You did out of conviction." She said, and then this really for me, she said, and we admired you for it. And I said, "Well, don't you feel that you've been terribly abused?" She looked at me and laughed. But this is the sociological content of thinking today. And it has entered the courts, has entered into society, it's entered the school, and it's a very, very dangerous move. And it comes from the irrationalism of these men. Yes, Mr. Pierce?
You mean by irrationalism, it's not rational?
I mean that it is contrary to the covenants of God, it is contrary to biblical revelation, it has no real meaning to it.
Which is the authority.
Right.
That is what's going on in the country at all levels.
Sure it is.
It's a breakdown of authority.
Sure, it's a breakdown of authority, which is a sign of irrationalism. Or one of the products of irrationalism, I should say. It's philosophical, theological irrationalism.